is number 23-3030, Hilsenrath against the School District of the Chathams. Mr. Thompson?
May it please the court, Your Honor, Richard Thompson, representing the plaintiff appellate in this case. I request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're back here again on a 5-minute video that was shown to a 7th grade, 12-year-old 7th grade class, a mandated class that they had to take for the purpose of completing their requirements. A part of that class was to examine the Middle East, North Africa, and the culture and geography of that area. And in
Mr.
doing
Thompson,
that,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but could I want to make sure I'm clear as to what's at issue now that this is the second time around. It's my understanding that the injunctive and declaratory relief is out of the case. We're just focused on the merits independent of that, correct?
Well, we're going to be talking about the application of the Bremerton, Kennedy versus Bremerton case on the facts of the case that brought us here in the first place.
Right, but you didn't discuss injunctive or declaratory relief. So those
aren't
part
Your Honor,
of the case,
right.
Correct?
We are only asking for, at this point, we are asking for nominal damages, et cetera,
okay.
Because our the young man has already graduated from high school.
Right. All right. So, and you mentioned Kennedy, and Kennedy changed things, correct? It got rid of the lemon test, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And how did it change things? How would you describe Kennedy having changed the law?
Before, you know, we had the lemon test, where it was a pretty, it was a test that was supposed to be applied across the board to all areas of religious freedom and the First Amendment. However, over years, it was in place, I don't know, about 50 or 60 years in place. It was very clear that it wasn't doing what the jurisprudence thought it was going to do. And then over time, and as you look at the cases, even before the Bremerton case, the Supreme Court was looking at history and the understanding of our founding fathers as to why the Establishment Clause and why the First Amendment free exercise clause was in place. So I think at this point we're looking at it from the lens of Kennedy versus Bremerton, which looks at history and the understanding of our founding fathers when they developed this.
Right, and that history, isn't it correct to say, allows for a lot more religiosity in public spaces than the lemon test allowed for?
When you say in public spaces, you're talking about schools,
including
and
public
government
schools.
Right. Government entities.
Correct.
Yes. In certain ways it does, but I think also that it does limit the aspect of utilizing religion, especially in the public school area, because
clearly in the devotional sense, right? I mean, the Supreme Court has precedents like Engle v. Vitale that, under current Supreme Court case law, you can't, for example, have prayer in public schools, correct? Devotional exercises, correct?
Right, devotional exercises.
Right, but this, I'm not sure I understand what was devotional about this. This was a world cultures class. So how, is it your argument, for example, that this school district could not teach about Muhammad, for example?
It could teach about Muhammad if it was an objective, in an objective way. They could teach about Muhammad if they said Islam believes that Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Right.
As a belief, but not as a fact. And that is the difference.
Well, isn't the video, isn't the cartoon video precisely that. There's a child who's identified as a Muslim, Yusuf, and he is articulating the tenets of his religion. And the tenets of his religion include that Allah is the one true God. Isn't that what the video does?
That cartoon does say that, and they do also talk about the Shahida, which is the principal faithful sentence of all faithful Muslims.
Right. So couldn't in this school district, couldn't they in the World Cultures Unit teach about Jesus of Nazareth? Or do you say that's off limits?
As a curriculum, they can teach about the word about Jesus of Nazareth.
Right. And then couldn't they also say that that Christians believe that Jesus is part of a triune God, that's a part of Christian doctrine?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And that could be taught in the public schools.
Yes, as long as religion, you cannot really have a well-rounded education unless you know about religion and the various religions. And that would give you an idea of maybe tolerance and understanding in a more diverse society that we live in today, in a pluralistic society. But the Abington case...
Well, but stick to the facts of this case for a minute, because I agree with everything you just said, but that seems to be supporting what the Chathams did here, because the entire point of the unit, which also included Hinduism, Buddhism, other grades in the same school district, talked about Christianity during exploration of the Western Hemisphere, correct? Well, So isn't the point here that the school district is trying to expose the children to the wide range of beliefs in the world cultures, and some of those beliefs include religious beliefs?
Yes.
And so what's the problem?
The problem is that in the introduction to Islam video, a five-minute video, they made the following statements without any comment about this is what Muslims believe, without any kind of explanation or disclaimer that this is not a belief that the school is endorsing at this time, one way or the other.
So basically,
here's what they said.
So what I hear you saying is it's one thing to just provide cold, hard facts. It's another thing to provide them in a context that feels like indoctrination or like proselytizing.
I think proselytizing is a very...
And so what I think you're saying is I've got a difference. And it seems to me that your entire complaint and action rests not on can they just talk in the abstract, but how they did it here. So you might have no grievance with another five-minute video that didn't end with visit a mosque and wasn't prepared by an outside organization that seems to be trying to convert. And so you might say, get me another video and I'm fine.
Yeah.
Your problem seems to be with these two videos and what's in those videos, the use of friendship to create a bond, the use of loss of friendship to create a sadness for not following Islam. All of these things is what I'm hearing you say. That's the problem I have with this video. Put another five-minute video on, we aren't here. Am I hearing your case right?
Yes, Your Honor, you are. And a very important part is that they also had a video on Buddhism and they had a video on Hinduism. If you look at the videos on Buddhism and Hinduism, they talk about facts. They do not try to proselytize you. In the five-minute intro to Islam, they end up with this, a part of the video. It says... May God help us all find the true faith, Islam. Amen. That's proselytizing.
But is a little bit of proselytizing okay? I mean, lemon's out. You know, I mean, I don't really know, right? Is non-coercive proselytizing? We know that at least this is my thing. But I'll put my cards on the table. As I see it. One commonality, pre and post Lemon, is coercion of religion is a bad, bad thing. It's unconstitutional.
Yes.
And so I guess one thought is, though, Lemon kind of moved proselytizing out, basically said, you can't do that. But Lemon's gone. Is a little bit of proselytizing around the edges now just kind of acceptable government speech as long as it's not coercive? Or is proselytizing, because it's not one of the six things referenced in Bremerton. It's not coercion.
We're
in a weird place.
There is still a separation of church and state. There's still these long histories.
How can you say there's a separation of church and state when every session of the Congress begins with a prayer? Where do you get that?
Well, again, you go back to, and Bremerton talks about that. And there's several cases that talk about that. That's a part of our tradition and history. That they even
part of our tradition and history that public schools started with a prayer. But the Supreme Court said that was invalid.
We didn't have public schools at the time.
Correct.
The colonies were there. Most of the schools were run by Church of England and then different Protestant denominations.
Correct.
We didn't have public schools until probably about 1830 or 40.
Right.
And then we didn't have laws that...
Back to Judge Phipps, I just don't understand how separation of church and state is an answer when there's a lot of, you start with George Washington's, statements that he made in his inaugural address, et cetera. But anyway...
There's a purpose.
Where do we draw the line? In a unit on Christianity, in a world culture unit on Christianity, would it be illegal for the school district to allow a video after they explained the basics of Jesus of Nazareth, the basic views about Christianity? Could the video then say, Happy Easter? Is that unconstitutional in your view?
Probably not.
Not unconstitutional.
So if
it's not unconstitutional to say Happy Easter, why is it unconstitutional to say, if you have any more questions about Islam, go to the local mosque?
Well, that starts the process of getting someone converted. But even that statement might,
How does Happy Easter not start the process of converting, but if you have questions, visit the local mosque? I'm not sure I understand the distinction between the two, other than they're two different religions.
Well, the courts say there's a play in the joints. There is some movement. And all of these cases are very fact-intensive. And therefore, you have to look at the free exercise clause, and you have to look at the establishment clause. Now, they're together sometimes, but if you push them to the extent, sometimes the free exercise clause runs into the establishment clause, and that's where the courts have to come in and make those distinctions. So it's not a clear-cut rule.
Mr. Thompson, we've said repeatedly that in the First Amendment context, we have to look at the whole record. And I understand your concerns with that video teaching about Islam, but the lesson was that after the children would watch the video, they would do an exercise about what generalizations can you make after viewing this video? Are they valid or faulty generalizations? There was also a worksheet that said, fill in the blanks. There is no God but blank, and blank is his messenger. This statement is the centrifugal force to their religion. What are we to do with that context that is in this record?
Well, again, you have that kind of situation where even a minimal of incursion into the establishment clause protection is enough. We don't try to make, it's not a de minimis kind of incursion.
Yeah,
if you violated the establishment clause,
you don't get to establishment until you look at all the context. So let's say the video is proselytizing, but then it's presented in the context of an assignment to list what the central tenets of the Islamic faith is, their religion, speaking in the third person, and to discuss generalizations in the video.
Okay. There is nothing wrong as long as you say that Muslims believe this, or Jews believe this, or Christians believe this. I think there's a place for religion in public schools. There's a reason for why we have religion in public schools. If you don't, if they want to teach it in an objective way, as Abington said you should teach it, not as a fact, not a, you teach it as an objective fact.
What about a conversion prayer? Can you teach a conversion prayer, an oral conversion prayer to students in an objective way, and that still be, because the Shahada, if recited three times publicly in front of witnesses, is a conversion prayer. And so can a school district say, you know what we're going to do? Just totally objective. We just want to teach you the conversion prayer. Do we have to look and see, if we're looking at the whole record, what the utility of teaching a conversion prayer is to understanding the peoples and the geography of Northern Africa and the Middle East? Is there any utility, maybe, for those goals in teaching a conversion prayer?
Well, I think, again, I'm not sure what a conversion prayer would mean, but if it's a conversion prayer that we want you to become Christian or we want you to become Islam, I think that's proselytizing. But I'm not sure what exactly the
I guess what I'm saying is I understand it, and maybe I needed more education on this as a middle schooler. The Shahada, if it's recited three times out loud in front of witnesses, converts a person to Islam.
Correct.
And
correct.
So is there value, I mean, in teaching, in a public school, teaching students, if you want to be this religion, this is all you need to do? Or these are the words that are done. Does that kind of take us? It's almost like saying, if you want to get baptized, these are the steps that you would need to do. Does that go too far? Or if that's done objectively, are you good with that?
I think you have to be objective. And I'm not sure exactly, again, how far you want to go. But I think I want to get back to what this introduction to Islam said.
I'm just having trouble with when you say objective, because there's a lot of case law from the Supreme Court in this area that talks about the court staying out of matters of doctrine, right? It's not the job of the United States courts to police or referee matters of Christian doctrine or Islamic doctrine or Jewish doctrine. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, they say that the court should not be concerned about heresy.
Right.
That's one of the statements they make.
Right.
If
the courts aren't supposed to be entangling themselves with matters of religious doctrine, doesn't it make more sense for us to focus on whether there's coercion involved rather than adjudicating the boundaries of any one particular faith? Because when you suggest that the courts are supposed to make sure that the schools are teaching religion in an objective way, that sounds like you're asking us to learn all the details of the doctrine of whatever faith is being taught.
Well, going back to, is it objective to say Allah is one God?
No, that wasn't my question. My question is, if we are engaging in this objective exercise, we run the risk of mediating ourselves into doctrine of the various religions of the world. But if we focus on coercion, we don't have to get into doctrine. Instead, we're just looking at the facts on the ground about what the government is doing to the student.
Well,
is the government coercing the student?
Well, again, coercing has a lot of different ways of coercing. One of the ways of coercing is when a school says there is no equal to Allah. He is all powerful. Muhammad is the last and final messenger. If you're a 12-year-old and you're sitting in that class, and you have to be in that class, and you have to listen to that and watch that video, you are being coerced.
So what you're saying is we have school prayer cases where there's opt-out. We have public prayer cases where you can just leave the football field. You can do all these other things. when you're in public school and you have to be there, otherwise face truancy problems, and you have to take this course on the Middle East, and then your assignment for the class is to watch this video, which might be a dispute of fact. It seems that the assignment was to watch the PowerPoint with a link to the video, and I'm not sure how that plays out. But strong form for you, you now have to watch the video, and the video has proselytizing in it. Is that enough for coercion?
I think that is, Your Honor. And again, we're looking at history, and the part of the history is our founding fathers realized that they wanted to keep a lot of this religion out of the government's hands because of the strife that it would cause. If I'm a Muslim and I send my child to a public school and pay taxes for public school, do I want to hear the teacher of the public school say, "For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son"? They, you know, and whoever
well, you might not want to hear it, but how is that coercive?
By just being there and being forced to listen to it is coercion.
Mr. Thompson, the children also had to watch a video about Buddhism that referred to the Dalai Lama as the supreme spiritual leader. Were they being coerced into Buddhism?
If they said, if it depends on where they say it in the context, but if they say this is what they believe, that's fine. But if this is a school of 12-year-olds, who are mandated to be there, whose parents pay taxes.
Well, they're coerced to be in school. We all agree on that.
Okay, so.
But being coerced to sit in school doesn't mean coerced to join a religion or join the tennis team or play in the marching band.
Well, there are cases, Your Honor, where the Alcoholics Anonymous, people have complained that I have to go there, and they have this idea of a supreme being as a part of, you know, their program. By sitting there and watching it, the courts can say that's coercion.
All right. You reserve some time for rebuttal.
So yes, Your Honor.
We'll hear you then. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Thompson. Let's hear from another Thompson, Ms. Kumar Thompson.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Ruby Kumar Thompson. I'm with the firm of Cleary Giacobbe, Alfieri & Jacobs, and we serve as Board Counsel and Litigation Counsel to the School District of the District of the Chathams. Your Honors, establishment clauses to the curriculum. To prevail, the plaintiff would have to show that the school district's curricular decisions have the students learn about and to compare and contrast the world's major religions by eighth grade promoted a particular religion, here Islam. There's not much I think that Mr. Thompson and I disagree upon in terms of the Establishment Clause. It forbids state sponsorship of prayer and most other traditionally religious activities at school, such as Bible reading for religious and moral instruction, offering religious instruction during the school day.
But a Bible reading for historical instruction, not religious instruction. For example, what if the curriculum included readings from Genesis in order to present one vision of how the world was created?
Your Honor, the Bible is an appropriate study in a secular program of education where it's instructing students on the differences in a supreme or divine being. I think that's what crosses the line into religious instruction.
Is it instruction or devotional exercises? Because, or are you saying that it would be unconstitutional for the school district to do a unit on Jesus of Nazareth?
For the purposes of just moral instruction and for the religious content alone, I would say yes.
It would be unconstitutional?
It would be unconstitutional to have devotional readings.
I didn't ask about I'm saying, could you do a unit that touches at all about Jesus as a historical figure?
Absolutely.
Could you also in that unit instruct the students about Jesus's life?
Sure, if it would touch on or explain the history and the people.
All right, and the history would include that for the last 3 years or so of his life, he was moving about preaching. that could be taught as historical fact in the school district?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And then finally, could they then say, well, and here's what Christians think about this fellow. They actually believe he is part of a triune God, and that, and some of his basic principles include things like loving your neighbor, and the Christians believe that that he was a virgin birth and rose from the dead on Easter Sunday. Could you teach the students that?
I think that's
what Christians believe.
Yeah, and I think that this school district did in sixth grade, and they studied.
All right, so then you could do the same thing with Islam, and the same thing with Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism and Baha'i and every other thing under the sun, whatever the school board thought made sense for the kids, right?
I believe so, as long as they did not prefer one religion over any other, religions.
What if one of the units was really just proselytizing? What if one of the units went a little further and maybe the Christian unit said, oh, and by the way, you know, this is how to get baptized. You want to be saved? This is how to get baptized. And it said, Christians believe that, you know, some Christians believe, maybe all Christians believe, you aren't saved unless you're baptized. And we just want to tell you that, because it affects the Christian worldview. And just throwing it out there, won't be saved. And if you want to get baptized, though, here's a list of how to do it. Is that okay? Because it does influence a Christian worldview, right? That's important to Christians. Most of them get baptized. If you want to understand Christians, you probably have to understand that doctrine of baptism. But if you teach that to seventh graders, are we really going to say, oh, shucks, yeah, that wasn't proselytizing. That wasn't undue influence on them. That was just cold, objective fact. Can it ever cross the line?
Yes, just because it has to have a rational relationship to an educational goal and a pedagogical goal.
And so would the example of baptism have that rational relationship, because it's critical to a Christian worldview to understand why Christians try to send missionaries all over the world to convert people, because they think that you have to be baptized to be saved. So if you say, hey, you don't understand Christianity unless you understand the role of baptism, could they lay into that pretty heavily and say, you know, by the way, if you haven't been baptized and you want some more information on baptism, here's a list of churches that'd be more than happy to do that. Is that okay?
Yes, Your Honor. If a student was told, there's a couple of different things in there. If a student was told, look, if you want more information, here you go. The students were required in sixth grade to study, to research each and every single religion and express what the differences were and in various categories. So, but in terms of religious instruction, meaning how to convert, specifically by in the mouths of the teacher. Here we don't have that situation. That's not what occurred here.
But it might be in the mouths of the video that the teacher assigned.
It was not in this case.
You don't think that there's anything that would appeal to seventh graders about those videos to put Islam in a favorable light about those videos, as opposed to just raw, pure bullet point, this is what you need to remember? It teases on friendship. They show each other's heart. The heart beats. One leaves. The other guy frowns when he leaves. He leaves because he wants to go to church. There's a sense of longing. I want to go with you to church afterwards. That's not kind of, you know, tenets of Islam. That's in a video that teases on the emotion of seventh graders, possibly. Your opponent's focus seems to be on these specific videos, not the overall curriculum. And no matter what the goals of the overall curriculum are, they can't save certain videos that would be off limits. Surely you can have the best curriculum ever and populate it with one bad video, and maybe the problem's that bad video. So as I understand his case, it's not a challenge to the curriculum, it's a challenge to two videos. Why is showing those videos presented by outside sources that seem to be designed, that have other purposes than education, why is that okay?
Your Honor, there's no formal religious activity depicted in any of the videos, and nor are there any specific words to encourage students to adopt the creator's views as their own, whether or not it is viewed in a positive light or a negative light. In fact, the video's start was to explain it was a video for non-believers. And like in Kennedy, the students were not required to attend any type of religious instruction. You can't say
but
just because it's proselytizing.
If it's for non-believers, doesn't that imply that there's some interest in converting? If it's a video for believers, you might do that. But why would you make a video for non-believers if conversion is not somewhere in the back of mind?
Well, it was clear to the students that that was not the purpose of the video. The purpose of the video, of course, was to make generalizations.
And purpose is kind of an interesting thing, right? Because purpose is lemon prong one, and it's gone. It's gone now. So I mean, you know, you might be right.
Context, but
that's gone.
Context still matters. Context still matters.
We aren't going to say lemon's gone, purpose is gone, but purpose comes back in through context. That puts us in a bit of a box, right?
Well, context matters in terms of coercion. So would this student believe that they were being coerced by just merely being exposed to religious beliefs and ideas? And I think the context informs whether or not a student is coerced into conversion, where there's no words for conversion. The teacher certainly did not.
It involves the conversion prayer, learning the conversion prayer. The Shahada, if I understand right, if said three times in front of witnesses, converts. And then they say, hey, here's the words you have to say to do that.
And that's
up to the line, but because there wasn't an oral exam asking you to say it three times, it's not coercion, is that right?
So, Your Honor, I don't believe in this case there was actually either a PowerPoint or a video that instructed students that if you say the Shahada three times, it was, I think that reference came from a link in the Discover UK Islam video that a student would have to click on to get to.
Link made available through the course materials.
Correct. And that's not coercive in any way, shape, or form to have a student research further through links that were the source of the information, meaning the Shahada, the exact words. Filling out a fill-in-the-blank one time with words that describe the main tenet of a religion is not anything that would be coercive to a student.
What if it was to act out a Christian baptism, just to make sure that you understood it? Would that be coercive? What if the exam was, we want to see you just to make sure that you understand where Christians are coming from? We want to see you act out a Christian baptism. Get the water, get the oil, just to make sure that you understand objectively what a Christian baptism is. Is that a problem if that was part of a test?
If that was the situation, Judge Phipps, I don't believe that there's any educational pedagogical value in acting out a baptism. What potentially possible educational value would that have to social studies, history, music of any shape, way, or form? I don't believe religious activity has that value.
So learning the Shahada has value and a baptism doesn't? Isn't that Judge Hardiman's problem, that we're now making value judgments about one item having value and another item not having value?
I don't believe that they're the same thing. So no one asked the students to say the Shahada three times. You're asking me about a practice. Can we demonstrate the practice? The teacher didn't demonstrate the Shahada. It was in a fill-in-the-blank worksheet. It was in a video just saying, okay, these are the five pillars of Islam that form the religious beliefs of those people. It is not about religious activity. Any coercion in a religious activity or in expressing prayer would be still problematic to this day, even after Kennedy, because it would be directly coercive to those students. Direct coercion, actual coercion, is what we need to look to. Practices in religion, acting out a baptism, I don't see any educational value in that or reference.
So one way to just really make it non-coercive is to give the student an opt-out, right? You want to say this is non-coercive, just say you can opt out of this class, or you can opt out of any unit you want, and you can take an extra gym class or get a study hall or something like this.
I would agree with that, and we had that in this case. The school district absolutely had an opt-out policy where the student could have opted out in any instruction that they found offensive or distasteful or that contradicted their own religious beliefs and
is that in the record? I didn't see that in the record. Do you have that in the record somewhere?
It's in the policy, yes. It was in the summary judgment motion. There's definitely a district policy that was submitted, maybe not in the appendix. I think that we had some disagreement on what should have been included in the appendix, but it definitely was in the summary judgment motion. We do absolutely have that opt out.
Thank you, Ms. Kumar Thompson.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Amicus Council, Mr. Tagliarella.
Good
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Pagliarella for, on behalf of Jewish Coalition for Religious Liberty, MECAS. Judge Phipps, I think the opt-out policy is at Appendix 18, Note 17. I believe it's referenced in district court opinion. Regardless, we would say that the Free Exercise Clause requires the same opt-out if possible. I just want to begin where Judge Hardiman started the argument on the text of Kennedy. I think it's helpful to look to what Kennedy says it's replacing. It disclaims the endorsement test as abstract, unpredictable, impediment to religious inclusion. So you look at the hallmark tests as contrast. It's concrete. It accounts for all the court's establishment clause doctrine, including Judge Hardiman's. You raised separating oneself, separating government from prescribing religious doctrine or prescribing church personnel. That may or may not always be direct coercion, but it is a hallmark. And it doesn't disturb efforts to promote religious tolerance. We like the hallmark test. We think it makes concrete what sort of coercion matters for establishment clause claims. As this course mentioned, all students are compelled to attend schools. You might find the lesson against anti-Semitism boring. You might find it not objective. I don't like how Judaism is being presented so positively. But that doesn't make it coercion in the nature of historical establishment, nor does it bump up against other establishment clause tests.
What about the proselytization issue? Could you address that?
Sure, Your Honor.
Can we draw the line on that, or should we draw the line, or should we just set that aside and focus exclusively on coercion?
Your Honor, the appropriate hallmarks here are proselytization. As we said, many forms of proselytization fall into the hallmarks. So coercing religious practice, punishing dissenting practice. I believe the plaintiff had the concern that he could receive lower grades for something. If he genuinely could have received a lower grade for not adhering to religious exercise and proselytization came in that form, of course, would bump up against the hallmarks. If proselytization means, in the colloquial sense, I'm hearing a lot about this religion, not the other one. Well, okay, you're hearing a lot about this religion because anti-Semitism is a serious issue in America right now, and that's why you're hearing more about Judaism. That colloquial sense of I feel proselytized because I'm hearing about this much more than other faith would not bump up against the hallmarks. Judge Phipps, I'm happy to address the baptism hypothetical. So, for example, I could imagine very well, and I've maybe even been to one, a drama class or a drama performance where you have a baptism in the play or somebody's reciting a prayer in the play. That's clearly not a devotional context, clearly a natural part of a curriculum. Of course, the children of my clients very well may have one opt-out from that, says, you know, I may not be comfortable doing the baptism, even though I know you don't mean devotionally. That's fine. It's a free exercise opt-out. In West Virginia v. Barnett, you know, the Jehovah's Witness saw the pledge devotionally, even if no one else did. That's fine. They should have an opt-out. That was under free speech. It's been incorporated for exercise more as of late.
Doesn't that opt-out undercut a lot of the Supreme Court's precedents, though, in the religion and public schools cases?
So, Your Honor, I think that the Establishment Clause certainly prohibits, again, directing students to engage in religious exercise, even if they have the opt-out. The opt-out I'm speaking is doing a lot of work that Lemon used to have to do before cases like Fulton and Tanton. But I certainly agree that it would still be a hallmark of coercion, coercion in the relevant sense of the Establishment Clause, to direct students to engage religious exercise, even if they nominally had an opt-out. Now, that doesn't mean that Kennedy leaves Lee exactly as it found it. Lee v. Weissman is referenced in the briefs at length, obviously includes the majority opinion in Lee and the dissent in Lee, and it relies on the dissent in Lee to begin to define the hallmark analysis. So I don't know if those cases are left exactly as you found it, but certainly the hallmarks recognize that coercion to engage in formal religious exercise, even with a nominal opt-out under the Constitution or under the school district's policy here, would still be a problem.
So you touched on this, but just for precision, you know, this hallmark test, I think we trace back to, you know, this law review article that Judge Professor McConnell wrote. It's got to be one of the most important law review articles because it kind of comes to law now. But, you know, it doesn't, proselytization and indoctrination don't fit neatly into any of those six hallmarks. There's not hallmark on proselytization / indoctrination. It's on public funding. It's on other things like this. So, like, what are we to make of that? Like, is the answer proselytization's a problem only so far as it fits into one of those hallmarks, meaning that proselytization that doesn't fit into one of those hallmarks is somehow okay?
So, I think the hallmarks make proselytization more concrete than you or I might use it colloquially speaking. So, again, compelling church attendance, punishing dissenting worship, the Supreme Court said compelling church attendance extends to compelling any sort of formal religious exercise, that's in Kennedy. You know, those are capacious concepts, right? It doesn't have to be coercion as tough as it was into the Protestant establishments. And the formal religious exercise can take many forms today that it didn't under Protestant Christian establishments, right? You know, telling the student to get 2 extra points on their test if they attend church on the weekend,
might be appropriate for parochial school. It's not appropriate under the hallmarks for public school.
But let's just say there was an exercise that was just lifted right out of a Sunday school curriculum, right out, right? And then it's taught for a week in public school. Just no test on it, no nothing like that, because there's no test in Sunday school typically, right? So it's the exact same curriculum that comes in Sunday school, and it's taught for a week at public school. Which one of the hallmarks is that in?
So, is he miles away from the situation, Your Honor, but to just hypothetical?
Yeah, I'm just trying to fit proselytization into the hallmarks.
So, if it comes in the form of compelling church attendance, for example, or if it's
doesn't.
Analogous to that.
It doesn't.
Well, it may. I mean, there maybe your hypothetical doesn't.
In my hypothetical, it doesn't. It okay. doesn't. It just, it's the exact same. It's the exact same curriculum from Sunday school. No tests, no nothing. Imported into public school. Which one, just where's the hallmark problem? So which hallmark is it?
If it's anything like my religious school, it'd be directing the formal religious exercise. It'd be directing the students to adopt these views and to behave accordingly. And that is something that Kennedy describes as a hallmark. It's sort of extrapolating it by analogy from compelling church attendance. Maybe it's paired with punishing dissenting worship, but clearly Kennedy says that's sufficiently analogous to the hallmarks, second and third.
You forgive me if I find that a little attenuated.
It may be attenuated, but it's an attenuation that I think is clearly in the text of Kennedy, that in cross-referencing these hallmarks and then explicating how they would apply today, says that compelling a formal religious exercise in any form would be a hallmark of establishment.
Can I switch gears to the opt-out? The opt-out's interesting because you could say the opt-out is compelled to keep establishment clause claims from not succeeding. Maybe it's something that we need under free exercise. Maybe it's something under Pierce and Meyer and Yoder in terms of parental rights. This is in the sphere of parental education, and you have to give parents the option to opt their child out. Does it matter here that there was an opt out? It doesn't seem to have gained much valence in any of the analysis.
Well, we're not arguing that an opt out would defeat a proper establishment clause under the hallmarks. We only argue, and we have another context, that an opt-out could be necessary either under a general free exercise right, those comparators, or, as you said, a parental free exercise right, which was, I believe, not raised and disclaimed in this case, but certainly the right of parents to direct the religious education of their children goes back and even named as Smith as an exception to general rules about neutral and generally applicable law. It's not raised in this case. We certainly think it's very important. It's miles away from a case where, as Judge Friedman brought up, you have a silly memorization exercise swapping a law with Allen, Muhammad, Martin Luther. This is not devotional. I see my time has expired. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tagliarello. We'll hear the rebuttal from Mr. Thompson.
Yes, Your Honor. From the questions from the bench, I understand that you're trying to plumb exactly what is proselytization and how far can the schools go without crossing that line? And that's a very difficult job to try to develop a red line. And that's why I think the courts say that you have to look at all of the circumstances. It's a fact-intensive decision that has to be made. But I would go back to the six hallmarks, I think, Your Honor, discussed. What Judge Gorsuch said, I believe, was this may be helpful as far as learning what should be prohibited. So it was just a help. But I don't think he meant that this is the sole test, those six characteristics are the sole test. I think if we go back to what the major concern that our founding fathers had, they did not want to have a government like the King of England and the English laws had regarding religion. And if you look at the schools as government, not as schools, but as government. In this case, it was clear by the 5-minute video that government was favoring Islam. If you look at the things that they said about all the various things.
But when they were studying Hinduism, then they were favoring Hinduism. When they were studying Buddhism, they were favoring Buddhism.
Except that if you look at the various videos, I looked at them side by side several times, there's a difference when they were talking about Buddhism and Hinduism versus this more deep emotional proselytization when they said Mohammed, you know.
Well, couldn't an argument be made that those religions are less susceptible to proselytization than religions like Islam and Christianity?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm not an expert, so I can't tell you what their purposes are, whether they have missionaries that go out like the Christian missionaries go out or like the Muslim missionaries go out and attempt to proselytize. But the concern is this. If we allow this to happen, this five-minute video, if that is the rule, then what we're going to have is other religions coming in, like the Wicca, and saying, we want our five-minute video. And then the Muslims say, or the Jews say, we want our five-minute video. We're going to turn public school systems into a culture war.
The school boards will have to adjudicate all those disputes.
And you know that school
boards... And you don't want them to.
Yes, Your Honor.
You want the federal courts to adjudicate those disputes.
Well, I think the federal courts will do a better job than school boards because a lot of this is political. And there's a whole idea of all these battles that went on for two centuries since our nation was founded were political. When one denomination got the power, they would do certain things. Even the religions that escaped England because they were being prosecuted, as soon as they got the power in the colony, then they kicked out everybody else. Or they discriminated against everybody else. We're going to have Catholics discriminating against Protestants discriminating against Catholics, and then we're going to have both of them discriminating against Jews.
Why doesn't an opt-out solve all of that?
Well, there's a lot of cases.
You say, hey, you know what, this is just not, we don't want our kids going to this. Well, they're opt-out, you know, you can teach all you want about X religion. But my kids are opting out. Doesn't the opt-out solve the coercion?
There are several cases, and I don't have them at the tip of my tongue, but there are several cases where there were opt-outs, and the court said that doesn't make a difference. And so that just because there's an opt-out, you know, in the Lee versus Weissman, those students could have walked out. They weren't forced to be there. There was that social pressure, I guess, to be there. But they could have walked out. Giving them an opt-out does not solve the...
That was an endorsement.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your time.
We appreciate your argument. We appreciate the arguments from Ms. Kumar Thompson and Mr. Pagliarello. The court will take the matter under advisement.